This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Yeah. Wait a minute, hold it. All aboard the Soul Funky Train.
Economist Robert Lucas has this, you know, question. You know, if you sort of looked at cities in the abstract, it's sort of a wonder that they sort of exist at all, given the number of, you know, the high rents, the various difficulties that we face in urban life.
Has this ever happened to you? You're sitting in your car, engine idling, watching the cars in front of you and behind you move only inches at a time, and you find yourself wishing you had opted for public transportation? So why didn't you? Were you deterred by the time you imagined it would take? Did the transport system's notorious unreliability make you nervous? Or perhaps the prospect of sitting on a dingy seat next to a smelly stranger kept you behind the wheel of your own car, where you know you're in control? Then again, how in control can you be? You've only moved a foot in the last 5 minutes, haven't you? Today on Sea Change Radio, my guest is Tom Vanderbilt. Vanderbilt is the author of Traffic, one of the New York Times' most notable books of 2008, and he recently wrote an article for Slate exploring the best way to get users to embrace mass transit. Together, we chat about the marvels and the miseries of both public transportation and driving, and muse over what it takes to get us out of our cars and onto the train. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by author, journalist, blogger, Tom Vanderbilt. Tom, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Great to be here.
In addition to a book that a lot of our listeners might know called Traffic, you just recently penned an article on Slate called What's the Best Way to Get Users to Embrace Mass Transit? It kind of splits urban planning into two different areas. Maybe you can explain it to our listeners where this idea came from and describe it in greater detail.
Well, I initially just set out to review a new book called Human Transit by Jarrett Walker, who's a transit planner. But as I was reading it, Jarrett was sort of making a lot of arguments that we're sort of talking about, you know, just we need efficiency in transit. Often what we think we need in transit is not what we actually need. And about the same time on the internet and various forums, he had sort of been paired against another guy named Darren Nordahl, who wrote a book called My Kind of Transit. And Darren's whole point is, as he puts it in one presentation, is making transit fun. There was this split over efficiency or fun. I mean, when I say fun, I mean sort of, you know, transit that you would actually want to ride in if you had a choice of different things, kind of pleasurable transit. And I sort of wondered, you know, if this was an actual split. I think sometimes we make too much of it, but it took me back to a presentation I had seen in Frankfurt, in which a guy was using some psychological theory from the study of Asperger's syndrome, of all things, which talks about, he's sort of breaking things into high system, which is kind of the cliche of people with certain people with Asperger's, that, you know, good with systems, patterns, numbers, versus empathy and, you know, being low on that scale. So you could sort of break all sorts of things into this system empathy grid if you wanted to. You could take a city. Let's take San Francisco. San Francisco probably does pretty well on both of those. It's kind of a place with a very good sense of place. It has what we call a soul. You could say that, but yet it's a pretty efficient city, compact, lots of good transit options. Anyway, just going back into that, there was sort of this dichotomy I saw between, you know, what kind of transit do we need? Does it just need to get us from point A to point B? Can it be actually a pleasurable experience? So I just wanted to set out and investigate some of those things in the review.
And how does this empathy versus system dichotomy relate to planning the sustainable cities of the future?
And it's tricky. In some places like New York, you actually don't have to think much about this divide. I mean, maybe we should think more about it, but a lot of people just need to ride transit no matter what, because it's really the only option. And there's a lot of redundancy built in, so people aren't having to make the choice that often of, you know, do I want to ride the subway today? I mean, it's sort of the only way. So I guess, you know, getting into the empathy side is a little bit more about places where you're actually trying to get people to switch from one mode of transit to another, where driving really is sort of a feasible option, and how could you make transit more appealing option, like, and I'm not, you know, there's various ways we could think about how that would be. Just clean transit, number one, providing amenities like Wi-Fi, making a better experience for driving. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think what drives a lot of this is that in the U.S. at least, the reason most people drive is that in most cases, it's still the fastest way from point A to point B mobility. So any talk we might have about the virtue of public transit, or whether it, you know, it saves you time or is more pleasurable, you kind of have to weigh against this basic fact in most people's lives that the car is the most convenient option.
I don't have the piece in front of me, but I remember reading an article last year that described how the next generation, the 16 to 25-year-old demographic, people have been getting their driver's license later and later. I remember when I was turning 16, it was just like counting the days till you could get your driver's license. I think that's changed a lot. And the article posited that it was due to kids being connected on their phones all the time and being happy just sitting down on a bus and texting each other all day.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting point, and one that I've looked into. And of course, as someone who got their license when he was 16 and started driving a lot of miles right after that, it's very interesting to me. And I think we do have to break it down a little bit. There is one factor, which is that in many states, we have things like graduated driver's licensing laws. So teenagers aren't able to get their licenses, their full licenses, as early as possible. And also, it's become a lot more expensive to drive and maintain a car. The insurance rates have really risen for teen drivers for a number of reasons. But you know, on the other side, looking at a lot of data from different countries like the UK, Japan, other places in Europe, you know, this is really this remarkable trend where I don't have the exact number in front of me, but the age has really pushed into the 20s, in which people are often getting a license. In some cases, they're not getting a license at all. But there is this sort of argument that, which then feeds into something like distracted driving, which is another great interest of mine, particularly since I just wrote this month's cover story for Wired magazine, which is about autonomous self-driving cars, such as you've heard about from Google, which is that, you know, if people are really so desperate to be on these devices, maybe there is this eventual need to simply take control of driving away from them. Of course, the easiest way to do that is just simply to put them on a bus or a train, but there is this other idea that people would still want point-to-point private mobility, yet have the option to do all this stuff that they want to be doing. But I think culturally you're right. There is, you know, the car in some cases has been eclipsed as a status symbol, as a signifier of something important, and even perhaps as a symbol of liberation and autonomy and all these other things. And it's really more important to be connected with your friends. I mean, you still need to get to see your friends at some point. But I think you're right, absolutely.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with the author of Traffic and the Slate transport columnist, Tom Vanderbilt. Tom, let's drill down a little bit more and discuss Walker and Nordahl's positions and how it relates. I thought it was pretty interesting, the example you give about San Francisco's cable cars.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess they had a little bit of a debate there. Jared Walker thinks that the cable car system is really essentially for tourists, that it doesn't connect up that much stuff as well as other options, and that the ridership is a minor part of the total picture of San Franciscans getting around in a day. Nordahl had some competing arguments that if you looked at the ticket revenue, it really, you know, it was people buying a lot of monthly passes and things, so it would indicate not tourists, and that it did connect well. So I'm not an authority on that form of transportation in San Francisco, but I sort of just added the point that, well, even if it strictly were for tourists, which I don't think it is, given the, you know, how important tourism is to the city of San Francisco and so many sort of, you know, postmodern metropolises in this age of consumption, that it might not actually be a bad thing to have a transport system that really moved tourists around in a way that would be better than, you know, private taxis or whatever. Kind of the Disney world model, which has, you know, Disney World has always sort of fascinated and evaded transport professionals because it is a privatized utopia, of course, that doesn't really work the way the real world works, but yet has an amazing transport system. It's bus system. If you took it out of Disney World and put it in a U.S. city, I think it would rank in the top 20 of bus fleets by size, just Disney World in Orlando. I guess you have to weigh out, you know, what is the actual demand and what are you substituting by that demand? Are you taking people out of cars? Are these people that would be riding some other kind of means regardless? But it's something that, you know, I think one of the problems is that when we see things like this is that we often experience them as tourists.
When you're not actually in a hurry and doing it every day, maybe that experience changes quite a bit.
Yeah, and I think at the end of the day, you know, there is something to this. Just you need coverage, you need frequency, you need something that works. And that I think the best transit system is really the one that you really don't have to think about, that you just go, you know it's going to be there in a few minutes, or it's always going to be there. There aren't even posted times because it comes so often. I mean, there's interesting work from some Swiss transport psychologists, for example, that people often fear public transport more than they actually, you know, their anticipated dislike of it ahead of time turns out to be much greater than their actual experience. They end up really liking it in the end. There's just this kind of adoption fear, which is one of many kind of strange psychological quirks that show up when we think about transport.
And usually that's inverse when it comes to smaller children who get all excited about riding any kind of mass transit system.
Exactly. And, you know, this you've kind of tapped into a future column I've been wanting to write because I have a 2.5-year-old myself. And, you know, the number of children's books I have in my house that have some kind of transport system as the theme is quite interesting to me. None of them really about cars. They're all about, you know, airports and trains and buses. And so I'm hoping that I can inculcate this love of you know, public transport in my daughter, at least through good literature.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm joined by author and journalist Tom Vanderbilt. So I lived in Japan for 4 years, and I don't know how much you've studied the Japanese rail system, I imagine, pretty extensively, but because it's a very fragmented system, it would be an interesting study to see which ones succeed and which ones don't based on how crowded they are, the price, the enjoyment factor, or the aesthetic quality of it. Maybe walk us through a little bit of the just traveling through Tokyo and seeing what works and what doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I really don't know all that much about the Japanese rail system, although...
Do you know how it started?
No.
It all sprung from department stores, like Keio Department Store back in the turn of, at the end of the Meiji period, like in the late 19th century. They would build a rail system to bring customers from the suburbs to their department store. So as a result, now we have like these huge systems like the Keio line, which is not just one line from the suburbs to their department store. They've shifted their models from being mostly retailers in a department store setting to running trains. And so you have these very fragmented train systems. Plus you have the national system, Japan Railway, which runs, JR runs the Shinkansen, the bullet trains. And it's an interesting microcosm in how they work, kind of a test bed for what we're talking about right here.
And they actually are profitable, as I understand. Is that correct?
I don't know. And you know, I've never looked at it from a policy standpoint. I've only looked at it from a consumer standpoint, and they definitely run on time and they don't cut back. They just seem to build more so that you'd assume they're profitable.
No, and profit, of course, doesn't, you know, it's not that a train system has to be, you know, per se profitable. This is one thing that Walker brings up, is that everyone sort of has their own, every profession has their own particular take on transit. An economist looks at it of, is it profitable or unprofitable? A urban planner might think of it, will this bring more urban development if we build this line? Someone else, you know, a social worker might say, will this serve underserved populations? We each kind of have our own interpretation of what transit should be. The people who run the cable cars probably are thinking about keeping some tourists happy, perhaps. But, you know, transit does have to serve, you know, many needs, and has many, we all kind of have our own image of what it is. And, I mean, unfortunately, a lot of people have very little image of what it is in this country. As I remarked in the piece, I was going back to Disney World when I was at a logistics conference in Orlando a few years ago, and they were talking about this amazing Disney bus system, and they were saying one of the things they did when a guest arrived was that if it was a child's birthday, they would, you know, give them a Cinderella, you know, tiara or something. And it was just this, as they got on the bus in the parking lot to take them to the park. And part of the reason they did this is they said that for many people it was their first encounter with public transit of any kind, so they had to kind of, you know, walk them through the system and make them feel comfortable, which I thought was kind of an incredible, you know, remark. And I'm not sure that would hear something like that in any other country, but this one. And of course, you know, one of the things that's happened in the last decade or so, I'm actually going down to Mexico City next month on a quick study tour of this BRT system and the Metrobus in Mexico City, which is that, you know, the train and the bus sort of merged into the so-called bus rapid transit, where the bus took on some of the qualities of a train, you know, platform boarding, that you're just sort of, you know, you're not stepping up into anything. It feels like you're actually getting on a train. It just goes one route and it takes you down Avenida Insurgentes, for example. You know, it feels like a train that happens to be on the street, and it's a lot cheaper. But, you know, it's an incredible system that now a host of U.S. cities are trying to, you know, look into and get this gold standard BRT. And, you know, the irony is that it's inspired by places like Curitiba, Brazil, and Mexico City, you know, which are not necessarily presumed to be in the vanguard of transportation.
And in your piece, you use that as an example of these type of cities, how they're laid out, how Nordahl versus Walker approach the favelas of Rio versus a more planned city. Can you expound on that a little bit?
Well, the person who kind of came up with the system empathy dichotomy was, you know, talking about like Dubai on the one hand, which is this sort of like new city, a lot of new infrastructure. You know, you say of it what you will, I haven't actually been to Dubai, but, you know, it's missing a lot of the kind of social infrastructure, or perhaps because it hasn't been around long enough, there's so much construction going on. From a transportation point of view, it's supposed to be a rather deadly city. Just they're building, you know, very wide multi-lane roads with pedestrian overpasses and things that, you know, haven't been, are sort of like considered to be, you know, outmoded really. But I'm digressing a little bit. But his whole point to that was not necessarily transit related. It was more just about how a place feels and what sort of social institutions there might be, and how something that looks like it might not have much, you know, quote unquote system, there might be a lot of informal mechanisms that help make the place actually work. And you can see that argument made with the favelas in Rio. But again, that's not necessarily a transit argument.
But when we think of the great cities in the world, we don't think of Brasilia or Dubai. We think of Boston or Rome or Rio, these places that are more vibrant and alive.
Yeah, precisely. And I guess none of the three things you just mentioned are necessarily known for amazing transportation systems. Which I guess, you know, gets into the question of what cities are for and why, you know, the economist Robert Lucas has this, you know, question, you know, if you sort of looked at cities in the abstract, it's sort of a wonder that they sort of exist at all, given the number of, you know, the high rents, the various, you know, difficulties that we face in urban life. And, you know, the reason they don't just sort of simply fly apart is that there is this enormous benefit, both economic and social and cultural, you name it, to being close to one another.
Damn this traffic jam, how I hate to be late. It hurts my motor to go so slow. Damn this traffic jam, time I get home my supper will be cold. Damn this traffic jam. Well, I left my job about 5 o'clock. It took 15 minutes to go 3 blocks. Just in time to stand in line with the freeway looking like a parking lot. Damn this traffic jam. How I hate to be late. It hurts my motor to go so slow. Damn this traffic jam. Now I get home, my supper be cold. Damn this traffic jam.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm here with author and journalist Tom Vanderbilt. So in your book, Traffic, you lay out a very interesting thesis that traffic planners should be or are looking at people as superorganisms, and you draw the parallel with ant colonies. First, why don't you describe a little bit about that so I'm not putting words in your mouth?
Yeah, I guess the traffic engineers have described to me there's always a tension in trying to design networks and systems where there's two situations. One is user optimality, and the second part is system optimality. And often, one does not equal the other. And you find this, take one example would be in the California highway system. You have the on-ramp with the ramp metering system. And the individual user comes up to, is getting on the highway, they see a red light, they're, you know, potentially annoyed a little bit, and it looks like the highway's moving, and then they say, why are you holding me up? And then the engineer knows that, you know, you need to sort of modulate that throughput a little bit. You can't just let everyone join the highway at once, or you're going to make the whole system work. So each person has to sacrifice a little bit to make the system function better as a whole. So, you know, the problem, you know, we don't have that ability. The parallel I drew with ants, certain army ant colonies, is that they have this kind of distributed intelligence through, you know, the using chemical senses and all sorts of things, where they've evolved over millennia to just be these hyper-efficient commuters and essentially, you know, supremely non-self-interested. And just if, for example, they encounter an obstacle in their path, you know, some of them will create a bridge, or they'll automatically slow down so other ants aren't overtaking, you know, this nice stream they have going. The incredible ways to sort of adjust themselves so they have the most efficient, because this is life or death for them. They start a new colony every day. Basically, they're going out looking for food sources and creating these highway systems and then having to bring stuff back to the queen and all this. So this is life or death. So just the idea is in traffic, to what engineers often try to do is bring some of this system optimality in through technology or infrastructure, because we don't necessarily have that capacity. We're very self-interested. We're in our cars. We are not necessarily willing to cooperate with other people. We can't see what the whole system is.
Basically not very altruistic in terms of our struggles to get from point A to B.
Exactly. And, you know, this is some of the hope with things like, you know, advanced traffic information systems. When you know the condition of the whole highway, exactly which roads are filled at which time, you can shift some drivers over to the unoccupied parts. But, you know, you're going to have to figure out some way to do that, probably by appealing to their self-interest and saying, hey, this is a faster route if you go that way. But again, it just, you know, if we could, you know, kind of achieve this ant behavior, and in some cases we sort of, you know, do almost sometimes, but
One thing I found fascinating within that was, yes, people are more self-interested than ants, but they also are more risk-averse, and that it actually leads to bigger traffic jam if you say construction ahead in 2 miles as opposed to construction ahead in 500 feet.
Well, I mean, just to put it in simple terms, you know, we've had this experience where we're driving along and you see there's 2 lanes of a highway and a sign says construction merge right 1 mile. And often you find this very long, early queue and you know, people getting into that lane that's going to remain open, leaving a lot of empty space all the way up to the merge point. And then you'll have a few people who are sort of, you know, adventure seekers or whatever, will go all the way to that merge point and then try to fight their way in. And so this is what, you know, this weird sort of anecdote got me started on the book, because I experienced this situation a number of times and just got to thinking about, you know, what actually was the most efficient way to move the most vehicles through, because I was encountering the argument that those people who were trying to go all the way to the front were actually making the situation worse. And this is something that, as individual drivers, we don't necessarily know how the system is performing. You know, it's like trying to observe some kind of high order physics and explain it just with, you know, layperson knowledge. It's just not actually possible. So it turned out that it was better if we could have this situation where people didn't abandon the lane early and went. We had this kind of alternating merge, and it seems like a minor point, but merging is just one of those things that occurs quite often. And is this, if we could just sort of optimize situations like that, it would theoretically make travel experience better. But
it's a little counterintuitive in that it doesn't explicitly appeal to human self-interest, like saying, "Hey, this is your high occupancy vehicle lane, and you're going to go faster in this one." Most people would think, "Well, I better just go over to the right because I don't want to have to fight to try to get in at the last second." A lot of people do that, but you make the case that it's actually more efficient if people don't all just get into their row right away.
Well, and this, you know, people often misinterpret this and apply it to other situations where things like jumping on an off ramp at the last possible moment to avoid the line, which is in an active traveling, I was really only talking about a very specific situation. And then, you know, in most cases, selfish behavior on the highway does not make traffic flow more smoothly. In this one case, it did. And there's a lot of cases where this, you can see this sort of behavior. Another interesting case was in Colorado recently. They were trying to get traffic to move more efficiently through some mountain passes. They were having a lot of really severe backups, and then traffic stopping really unexpectedly, and then you have things like rear end crashes. And again, it was the situation where the system was not performing optimally. And how did they conquer this? They actually introduced these platoons of police cars to go through and set an artificially lower speed that people were previously traveling at to kind of, you know, in essence, kind of calm and pace this traffic. And people were upset about this because they were used to traveling, you know, 65 miles at a certain peak. Now they were being asked to drive 45 miles an hour. But at the end of the day, they got over the whole stretch of highway at a faster rate than this previous kind of uncontrolled situation. So it was, again, kind of making this certain sacrifice for a better performing system, which still was the best for individuals in the end. It's just that we couldn't see that. We couldn't sense that. And I think, you know, there's probably a larger metaphor in there for, you know, society. But
sure. Well, that's why it's such a fascinating discussion. So when urban planners are trying to figure out human self-interest and what's going to motivate them, obviously that goes into building lanes for roads. It also is part of what goes into calculating whether it makes financial sense and whether it's going to be more efficient to have certain bus lines or train lines built.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think we all of us make these, you know, sort of decisions, you know, very instinctively and very ruthlessly. Some of the, you know, most efficient, I mean, carpooling as a societal activity has unfortunately, you know, declined quite a bit since the 1970s oil embargo period, when it was really, you know, institutionalized and, you know, it was kind of a cultural sensation. I mean, it still exists in certain situations in San Francisco, for example, the so-called sluggers, whatever, who, you know, people who are really taking advantage of some strong incentive to jump in a stranger's car and, you know, to. So I think, you know, we make these choices individually every day. I'm a New Yorker who has a car that's not. I probably put more miles on my bike every year at this point than my car, I would say. And each time I leave the house, there's sort of a little, you know, calculus going on of which mode I'm going to take, and it involves, you know, a complicated set of things. And very rarely is the car the best option. But unfortunately, you know, America, we're down to a monocultural transportation system in many places where the car is really the only option. But that's another discussion, I suppose.
Tom Vanderbilt, the author of Traffic and Slate's transport columnist, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
My pleasure.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by the JBs, JJ Kale, and James Taylor. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Farm Fresh to You Organic Produce Delivery Service, connecting people to farms and leading the progressive change in America's food system. To learn more, go to farmfreshtoyou.com. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.